Hey, welcome back, guys. Welcome back. It's so great to see y'all again. We have a new panel on stage and thrilled to be next to them. Not that I wasn't thrilled to be next to our first panel. However, I would love to introduce them, and please give a big round of applause to our new foursome. First of all, to my left, he is the lead Cardinals beat writer at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. He gets to deal with all of the questions in the weekly Cardinals chat. And the outgoing president of the Baseball Writers Association of America, Derek Gould.
Outgone.
Not outgoing, because that would suggest it is an ongoing process. He is outgone. Next, to Derek's left, from MLB.com, covers the Cardinals, formerly covered the Pittsburgh Pirates, and has access to all of the StatCast data. Jen Langosch is here. I like that little music interlude.
You have a theme song.
Was that your walk-up music?
Apparently so.
By the way, a quick interlude. I love that Dorothy from St. Charles wrote into the Post-Dispatch sound-off section and said, Colton Wong, I don't like your walk-up music because it was a Bruno Mars song, and it included the words sex by the fire all night. So as a employee of the Post-Dispatch, Rick Hummel, please respond to that. Rick Hummel, the Hall of Famer, the commish. He needs no introduction. He is here. What an honor. Is that your walk-up music, commish?
That's actually what he plays while he's writing.
Hang on, commish, a quick interlude. You're telling me a story about a concert you went to. You got a little too close for comfort. Give us that story real quick.
For the older members of the audience, Rare Earth was one of my favorite groups in the 70s. And I decided we'd go over to see them at the SIU Edwardsville, grassy field over there in Edwardsville. And I thought, well, I'm going to show off here. I'm going to get fourth row seats. That was a little too close to hear Rare Earth, by the way. I can barely hear now.
And finally, to Commish's left, new member of the St. Louis sports writing community, past president of the Baseball Writers Association of America. We'll say not outgoing, but very outgone, past president. Jesus Ortiz is here. And Rick. See, we've got multiple presidents of the Baseball Writers.
Yeah, the next president. You'll be the next. Right?
I don't think I'll be around that long.
Could you replace the current president? Not of the Baseball Writers Association, just like of America. All right, so same thing. We're going to chat for a little bit, and then if you guys have questions or whatever, we would love to have them. I am thrilled to be sitting up here with you guys just because of the wealth of teams that you have covered, the personalities you have covered. And my first question, we'll start with Derek, and I was thinking about this yesterday as we were talking to members of the 67 team and dealing with some of their personalities. Tell me the biggest personality you've dealt with and how that has presented potentially a challenge for your coverage.
Oh, you're talking about like biggest like star personality?
Not necessarily, just like the biggest personality and the consequence positively or negatively that's had on what you try to do.
I mean, they don't get much bigger than Tony La Russa. I mean, Tony La Russa was a pulsating personality. I mean, he would fill any room he was in, and three others he was nearby with the direction he was gonna command the conversation. He was gonna tell the best stories. He was gonna have the right answer to everything. And I mean, that was a challenge, but it was also a thrill, man. I mean, you had to be prepped and prepared to ask him a question. You had to bring it, and you had to be ready for a Lincoln Douglas debate, to get through it.
So it. I did LD debate in high school.
I'm no shock.
Would you compare him, much better than policy, would you compare him, see, we're talking now, would you compare him to Greg Popovich, Bill Belichick, or what?
Because, I never covered any of those guys.
Well, but I've heard people say,
I covered Dan
you
Issel.
Ask Greg Popovich a question,
no.
Obviously, he's going to
no.
give you a smarmy,
I understand what you're saying. No, he
get out of my way answer.
No chance. I would not because,
so
and Rick
thoughtful.
Can back me, and And he had a really good reason for this, I thought. And Rick's probably heard this conversation or this description a lot. Was he's when he was a young manager, Tony La Russa would describe that the owner of the White Sox came in and was asking him why he made some move of some type. And, you know, Tony waffled and didn't really articulate the answer. And he realized then, well, shoot, I better have an answer for every move. My gut, or because I thought so, isn't a good enough answer, especially if it goes awry. I better be able to defend all this stuff. And I think the fallout from that story was he thought, well, the owners read the newspapers, and I better give the owners the newspapers an explanation, because that's how the owner gets it. And that was always beneficial to us, I thought, Rick.
Yeah, I thought Tony was great for us. I mean, you sometimes was a lot of times on his terms.
Oh, yeah.
But
yeah.
If you had a question, he'd answer it. It might not be the answers you wanted to hear, but he'd answer the question. If it was even apart from whatever group session was held before, you know, you'd go up to him later on and say, hey, can I get you for one more second? He'd say, yeah.
He is a huge personality in the sense that, like Rick said, a lot of things were on his terms. So sometimes you had to, well, even now when we talk to him, you have to speak in sometimes Tony lingua franca. You know, hey, I'm going to term this in your words so that you appreciate at least where I'm coming from. So that's part of it. But you also have to take the other side of the personality, which is sometimes you're going to be part of the show. And I remember I took a shard from a bat when I was part of the show. He slammed his bat against a wall because ESPN had showed up to ask him about Mark McGwire and whether Mark McGwire should be honored and all the allegations of steroid use, performance enhancing drug use. And Tony was so angry that he wanted to put on a show. And he walked right down that hall at the old Busch Stadium right by me, slammed the fungo bat. And I mean, he wasn't genuine. He was putting on a show to make a point that you don't ask that question or that wall is going to get beat with a bat, and the reporter next to that wall is going to get hit with shards.
Were you okay?
Yeah, I'm fine. Yeah.
I mean, I know you
it's
are now.
It's a fungo bat. It's not like shrapnel.
Matheny's been carrying that same fungo bat for a long time. I wonder what's going to make him hit that into the wall.
I don't think he's Derek. A show guy. Oh, thanks.
Jen. Maybe Derek at spring training. Jen, how about you? Biggest personality that you've covered for better or for worse?
Yeah, this is very different than Tony La Russa. Nigel Morgan, a.k.a. Tony Plush. I covered Niger during my 5 seasons in Pittsburgh. I don't remember. He was there probably 2 or 3 years. But Niger was a screw loose or two. And you never knew when you went to go and talk to him whether you were going to get Nigel Morgan, the baseball player, whether you were going to get Nigel Morgan, the former hockey player, or if you were going to get Tony Plush or whatever new alter ego he decided to pick on that day. So, I mean, he was a great interview, a lot of fun. I don't know what he's up to now. I wish he were a commentator somewhere. But, yeah, Nigel Morgan, I don't think he'll ever be matched.
That series against the Cardinals, did that escalate as quickly a rivalry as you've seen? Was that as quickly a boiling point has reached as you've seen between two teams? And before we get to Jesus about the personality, Rick and Derek, that series, Cardinals-Brewers.
Well, the Cardinals-Brewers really didn't have much of a rivalry because they were in the other league.
Because the Brewers sucked!
Well, plus they were in the American League until the late 90s. and they weren't very good, too. But
both.
And Nigel Morgan and Carpenter had got into it one time, you know, Carpenter got into it with almost everybody, really. And Nigel Morgan was like a little bug. He shouldn't have bothered anybody, but he did. But, yeah, the playoff series got a little intense, and the rivalry has, I guess, I wouldn't say escalated, but it's still decent. As long as Braun still plays for the Brewers, the people can hate
but,
him.
But, I mean, it was tense during that week and a half, wasn't it?
It was fantastic because you had the rivalry with Ned Yost and Tony La Russa.
Brewers were really, 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 really good.
And they were really good. And you had Prince Fielder, who brought an edge to the ballpark.
That was the team that traded for Sabathia, too, right?
It was, yeah. Yeah. No, Greinke. Yep.
Or Greinke.
Greinke. And that added to it, too, because remember he said that Carpenter's a phony. And he just, I mean, and Zach Greinke just can't help himself sometimes. He's so candid. But he was just, I'll never forget that. I was like, wait, what? Because you almost become conditioned to, expect the cliche, and then when he's at the podium and one does not come spilling out of his mouth and it's actually like an answer, even if it's not a thoughtful answer, but he just says, Chris Carpenter is a phony. It's like, wait, whoa, ASAP Sports, run that back? What did he just say? That was an incredible day at the ballpark.
Yeah, I don't know. Greinke did have that way of yeah. getting under people's skin a little bit.
Well, he's a little, like, eccentric. He's just a different dude, yeah.
Yeah, he's very eccentric, and he is also he's very blunt in the sense that even if you ask him a question that he does not think is smart, he will either rephrase the question for you and give you an opportunity to try again or tell you that's not a very good question and you wasted your time with me and walk away.
Speaking of Greg Popovich, we've come full circle now. Jesus, big, you've covered some incredible personalities, especially down in Houston with some of the controversy surrounding some of the stars of that team. The biggest personalities or stars that you've covered and how covering those personalities affected what you did as a writer.
It's a three-way tie. I had Bobby Valentine in New York, where he didn't speak to half the beat writers, and then I had.
So he picked and choose.
Yeah, like he had.
That's like Steve Carlton. Well, I guess Carlton just didn't talk to anybody.
Well, he knew how to manipulate the media, but then I also had Ricky Henderson, and Roger Clemens. So Ricky Henderson, he didn't know what vested meant. So in 2000, he didn't think he should be there because his contract had vested from 99 because of at bats, and he said no. So that whole spring, he wanted to talk himself out of being with the Mets. So you'd go talk to him, and then you'd think you had a story, and then the next batch of reporters would go talk to him later, and the next day, three of us had one story, three of us had another. And you're trying to compete, and we're like, does he want to stay? Does he want to leave? And then
so is the Ricky Henderson Olerud story true?
No, it's not true.
But it's fantastic.
But
yeah.
And
they're real. Wait. They're fantastic.
And in today's world, it's so true. It's an alternate fact.
Yeah. It wasn't true, but it's. Everybody who knew him, it could be something he said.
Do you want to tell it real quick?
Do you want to tell the urban legend?
Well, Olerud went. He played first with a batter's helmet because he had had a concussion when he was in college or something like that. And what's the story? Ricky Henderson saw him and said, "I used to play with a guy like that." That was essentially the story.
So he was in Ricky was in Toronto with Olerud there. Olerud joins the Mets and walks out on the field with the hard hat on. And Ricky Henderson goes up and goes, "Man, you're not going to believe this. This is so funny. I used to play it with a guy in Toronto who did the exact same thing."
But he didn't.
And Olerud goes, "That was me." No, it was another guy. He played for Toronto. You're with the Mets.
And it wasn't true, but Ricky had said so many silly things that it just became urban legend.
Like he framed his first check?
Yeah, that is true.
That is true.
He framed his first $1 million check, and accounting had a column to wonder why he hadn't cashed it. It's on his wall.
What was it like to be in Houston when Roger Clemens was there because of not only the circumstances of how he joined the Astros and the subsequent success, but also just the frickin' star power of Roger Clemens and the fact that that was his state. It was Roger Clemens.
Yeah, he's the first and probably only athlete that I covered who knew his greatness. Like, no, I mean, he got it.
Besides Ricky Henderson.
But the way he handled himself, he knew when you needed him. He took pride. Like, in 86, he was the All-Star Game MVP. So we have the All-Star Game in 2004, and it was Roger Clemens. You were there, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he was playing. There's the All-Star Game gala, and he's literally playing with Curt Schilling and all these other ball players, like deep into the night with the band. I forget what the country band.
So he's like, he's literally like Bill Clinton. Like I've heard people say that about Bill Clinton. Like, he walks into a room, he knows exactly, he's like, I'm Bill Clinton. Mm-hmm. And it's over.
Yeah, and you know, I've had a great relationship with Roger to the point where the Daily News once called me his mouthpiece. The only, in their book, like, they literally call me his mouthpiece. But I had a great relationship with Rusty Hart and his lawyer, and the only apology that he's ever issued was an apology that he issued about when he admitted that he had made some mistakes in his marriage. And it was tough because this is a guy who took care of people close to him. He took care of everybody in town, did raise so much money for Houston, lent his name for everything and anything. And Brian McNamee, like, took advantage of that. And I'm not saying that he did do something or didn't do it. I don't care. But if he hadn't been so trusting, he'd have been okay. But he all his siblings, and his sisters will beat you up.
But hang on, like, he did steroids.
No? I don't know who did or didn't do anything.
All right. I mean, hey, here's the thing. Like, my thing, like, that was a part of baseball. People were in St. Louis, and I talked to McGuire last week. I was living in Chicago. It's incredible to me that no one during any of that was like, they're like, well, they're lifting weights. Like, it was unbelievable. But, like, if you just get out in front of it, like, Andy Pettit was still playing. And, Commish, I'll ask you, in terms of guys' legacies, Andy Pettit stood up there and said, you know what? I did it. I think he had his uniform on. He may have pitched that night. And everyone just let it go. But the guys who tried to sweep it under the rug, what does that say about baseball? And what does it say about that time period?
Well, the most surprising aspect of all this to me is that people think that only the hitters were the ones taking steroids. You think
or
none
only
of the pitchers?
The big guys. Yeah. Like, you could be recovering from an injury. You could be a 160-pound relief pitcher recovering from an injury, right?
The speedy little guys were the first ones caught.
Or Roger Clemens.
There were some pretty mediocre ball players who were taking steroids that were no good before they took them and no good after.
but they cost some guys who didn't their jobs, and I think that's part of, like, the uncovered, you know, I mean, there's a few guys who we both know and we've covered who played behind guys who did use, who played behind guys who were more durable because they used, who lost at bats off their own career, lost arbitration awards off their own career because they did not. I think that's part of that story is not just the little guys and the pitchers who used it, but the guys who held roster spots because they used, and more talented players but clean players, they wiled away at AAA.
Andy Pettit is the one who kind of had me wake up to it because I stopped believing because Andy Pettit had this pious reputation. And Andy Pettit lied to my face. When there was the Grimsley report, Allison Footer and I were there in Atlanta last day, this report, so we have to go chase it. And he told us, I've never done it. Like, look, the strings. And this is a guy who was part of the church choir. And this is how naive, stupid, this is how stupid I am. So he's caught. He admits it. Like, he's in the Mitchell report. He admits it. He text messaged me, in spring training. Jesus, I'm about to give my meal. Can you please drive down to Tampa? And I'm so stupid that I'm still telling people, like, Andy Pettit's the most honest person I've ever covered. He lied to my face. And I'm, but you know, like, and when guys, a lot of the guys, reporters I talk to, the Mitchell report, guys that we thought we were close to, unless you have a subpoena, they weren't going to admit to what they did. So we don't know who did or didn't do.
I mean, I just think that by standing up there and admitting it, everybody forgot about it the next day.
Well, you have proof here, right? McGuire changed his narrative arc by admitting, right?
So, and
I mean, he goes out there, has his moment with Bob Costas. He called Rick. He called Bernie. He called the late Joe Strauss individually. He called Matthew Leach, was the beat writer at that time there, called him individually. The next day, I was there with him in California.
Well, and here's a bigger picture question.
He changed the whole thing, and it was exactly as his wife predicted. His wife said, admit it and watch things change, and he's going to get a red coat this fall.
And not just that, but I'll ask you guys, what was it like when he came back as the hitting coach? And there was kind of this don't ask, don't tell almost around baseball for a while. He went through his, you know, public car wash and said what he had to say. He came back. It obviously took a lot of convincing for him to come back. What was that like to then cover him as a coach, but also as this guy who we can't really brush under the rug what his past is?
It was incredible. I mean, it was fantastic.
The first 2 days of camp is what you're referring to, when everybody from every national outlet, all the New York guys, everybody who had their hatchets ready, poised to go after him, and he answered every question and more. And to a man, these guys left and said, well, we didn't necessarily get all the answers we wanted, but we asked all the questions, and he answered them all. So we're done. We're done here. And it was over, basically. And for us,
all season?
Pretty much,
every new city.
Yeah.
He would go out and sit on the bench and wait.
You've never seen a hitting coach.
But he knew it. He knew it. And he owned it.
And as a coach, he was quite accessible, you know, much more so than he was when he was playing. I understand that part. But, the first couple days in spring training turned everything around. Now, that didn't help his standing in the National Hall of Fame voting. He got fewer votes, actually, after he came out than he did when he was sort of on the fence.
He was probably the most accessible coach I've covered here. I don't know about you guys, but, I mean, in my 6 years here, Mark McGwire was around, and he was so smart in the way he could teach you and talk about hitting. I felt like a student of his learning about the sport. And I didn't cover him as a player, and I didn't cover him when he first came back as a coach and kind of went through that gauntlet. But to me, it just seemed like he had been totally disarmed and was very comfortable in who he was, loved the craft, and really loved speaking and teaching us about the craft.
Yeah, I mean, the three people, the four people who inform my questions to this day with this coaching staff or with any coaching staff or any game, the four people who have poured more into me and taught me more about the game are Tony La Russa, whether he wanted to or not, Dave Duncan, who wanted to, Mark McGwire, and Rick Hummel. And they inform almost every question I ask. If I go and talk to John Mabry, or a few weeks ago I got to talk to Mark Budaska, who's the AAA hitting coach, in talking with him, I understood what he was describing and was able to kind of hopefully translate it to layman's terms because of Mark McGwire. Because Mark McGwire would take the time to show us and to explain to us what his hitting philosophy was and not treat us like dullards.
Outsiders.
Yeah. Yeah, or worse. Yeah, what's below outsider and stupid?
That's you couldn't possibly understand the game.
You could button a uniform. Yeah, that kind of stuff. Which I've heard.
By the way, Mark Budaska and Tommy Pham, I hear, think that Tommy should hit 98 home runs. Inside joke. Questions, anyone? Yes, sir, right here in the middle.
So we're just talking about Mark McGwire and the 90s Cardinals. Ray Lankford's always one of my favorite Cardinals players, and the fact that he is so underrepresented in kind of Cardinals lore, yeah, I think is a real disservice. And I was wondering if you had any thoughts on that and maybe other players that were kind of treated the same way by this organization or other ones.
Well, I will tell you this, that Ray Lankford, they've had four classes for the Cardinals Hall of Fame, and he should have been in one of them by now. Was he the best player of all those guys who went in? No. Was he here as long as any of them? Darn right he was. Here 12 years, and he was a really good player for many of those years. He has the record.
And still one of the nicest human beings you will ever meet, too.
He belongs in there for a number of reasons. One is he has more home runs at Old Bush than Mark McGwire did by just a few, and he played a few more years there than Mark did, and I grant you that, but
the all-time career leader, Bush, too.
He did it. He was a Gold Glove outfielder for a while. In 96, he was hurt. He might have won the World Series that year. He'd been healthy because he got hurt, missed almost all the San Diego series, played the Atlanta series, which they lost in seven games, but he could barely do anything. And then, of course, there was no World Series. But now, he wasn't maybe Tony La Russa's favorite player to manage. Joe Torre, I think, got along with him pretty well. Red Shanding's managed him every 10 years, it seemed, for a month. He's undervalued. Now, I guess maybe the statement people would use most often about him was that, well, with that talent, he should have been better. Well, okay, maybe he should have been, but he was still pretty good the way he was.
Great point. Derek, anything to add?
You asked who are some of the – I mean, Matt Morris. I think two guys stand out to me as far as Cardinal history, and one of them is in the Hall. Bob Forsch is in the Cardinals Hall of Fame, but I don't think he's as well known in the lore because you hear a lot about Chris Carpenter, you hear a lot about Bob Gibson, but Bob Forsch should be part of whatever discussion of pitching that there is for the team. And then Matt Morris, I think, as far as the genesis of the current era, he was one of those like patient zero guys and isn't regarded as such. And I think that's fascinating. Well, I think that's unwarranted.
Bob Forsch, I have to tell one story here, if I may. The second no-hitter that he pitched was on the last Monday of the season against the Expos. And in the afternoon, it was 1983, in the afternoon, the Cubs, whatever had happened in the afternoon, somebody had lost or won, and the Phillies had now clinched the division, so that Montreal was chasing that game. That night's game meant nothing. All the teams were done except for the Phillies. And the week before, Forsch had pitched against the Expos in Montreal, and Gary Carter had annoyed him for some reason, and he said, you know what? He says, the next time I face Gary Carter, I'm going to hit him. Okay. Well, it turns out here comes the next Monday, and now he's pitching this no-hitter, and it's like the fifth inning. He hits him right in the butt just because he said he was going to. So he pitches the no-hitter, and then now after the game, we were at afternoon papers still. That was our last year as an afternoon paper, so I was going to have plenty of time, I thought, to talk to him. So I went down to the Montreal side first. Vern Rapp was coaching for Montreal, then former manager of Forsch, and Gary Carter. I had to talk to Gary Carter about this, and he gave me some stuff. And now I'm about a half hour late to the Cardinal Clubhouse, and there's Forsch. He's pretty much all by himself. He's got two bottles of champagne there. And he says, oh, I suppose you want an exclusive interview now. I said, yes, I do. He said, here, drink this champagne with me. So we each drank a bottle of champagne as I'm doing this. And he gave me all the material I wanted. And then we worked at the office. I drove back to the Post-Dispatch and tried to make Heidner hair out of these notes I had in front of me here that I'd written, drinking champagne. But it came out okay. But Forsch was one of those guys that if he said he was going to do something, just as he did in the 87 championship series with the Giants. Jeffrey Leonard, you may recall, had annoyed the Cardinals along with Chili Davis, and so Forsch is pitching in the third game in relief in San Francisco, hit him right in the ribs, just because.
Commish, with that being said, I'm going to need you to tell the story of your first day covering Cardinals baseball when you got the call up. I'm not going to say that you Wally Pipped, but your first day and your grand entrance.
Well, it was in 1973, and Neil Russo, longtime Post-Dispatch ball writer, was unable to make it that night for some family reasons. So I was called at the last minute, and I got there, oh, heck, about the 7:30 game. I got there about maybe 6. We didn't go as early then. You know, we go at 2 now, but you could go at 6 and cover a night game for an afternoon paper. So I walked in those double doors.
Like the main entrance to the ballpark?
It was kind of a main entrance, but you could go in there, and then the clubhouses were downstairs, which I didn't know anything about that. But I thought, well, I'm going to go in these doors, and if you kept walking, you'd be right at the top of the box seat area. So I went through those doors too, and I started making my way down through the seats. And I thought, well, I'm just going to jump onto the field. Just jumped over the rail onto the field, And Gene Mock was managing the Expos. They were just starting batting practice, and he's probably saying, well, who is this Hoosier here? And I, the first guy I saw on the field besides Gene Mock was Boots Day, who had played with the Cardinals a couple years before that, and I'd heard of him at least. And I thought I went up and introduced myself, and Boots Day was the first guy I talked to. This game ended up being a four-and-a-half inning, one-to-nothing game that the Cardinals won over the Expos and Baylor and Moore, who was pitching. Mike Tyson, who rarely hit a home run, hit a home run for the only run of the game. So I thought I should go in and talk to Baylor Moore about that afterward. And I informed him that that was like Tyson's second home run of his career. He says, oh, that's just great. Thank you. He said something else, too, but that's not important.
How about a round of applause for the Hall of Famer, Rick Hummel? All right. Anybody else got it? Yes, you, sir, back there.
Like Rick mentioned, you know, when McGuire made his admission, there was changing in voting when it came to Hall of Fame. So where do you guys stand when it comes to the steroid era and voting for the Hall of Fame? Because obviously you have writers who are – there was one year where Clemens and Bonds had different amounts of votes. So is it something you have to choose a side? Do you cherry pick guys? What do you guys stand on that?
It's a great question. Let's start with Jesus down in the end, and we'll work our way all the way down.
I got my first ballot on Mark McGuire's first year, and I didn't vote for him because I didn't think he was a Hall of Famer. I didn't think he deserved it. But I've always, and I've written about this, and I went to a Christmas party once where the host says, my dad's here, please avoid him. He's pissed off because you vote for guys who did steroids. And my thinking is, I think there were guys already in the Hall who cheated. There are guys that I was very naive that I thought were clean who weren't clean. So because I don't know who did or didn't do steroids, I just vote based on how I think they fit. And I don't take steroids into granted, if you tested positive, like Palmeiro, I never voted for because you're this close to 3,000 hits and you get banged. That's just stupidity. That you're just like insulting the. So I didn't vote for him. I haven't voted for Sosa, but that's because the ballot has been so. There aren't enough spots for the ballot. But I don't consider whether they did or didn't do steroids. I just assume a great majority of them may have. So I just vote on, you know, Roger Clemens, Barry Bonds, Mike Piazza. I covered Mike Piazza. Guys that, you know, Jeff Bagwell. I just vote on how they stack up against their colleagues.
It's a tricky issue. And I decided about, I guess when Bonds and Clemens came on the ballot, the suspicion was awfully strong that they were somehow involved in PEDs, just somehow. And there's enough guys on that ballot. There's a very full ballot every year that comes out now. You can find 10 guys that you think are Hall of Famers without having to worry about, oh, gee, Bonds, Clemens, Sosa, McGuire. So I haven't voted for any of them. I can still easily find 10 guys. I can vote for Larry Walker. I can vote for Alan Trammell, as I did when he was in there. A bunch of other guys. Jeff Kent, I think, is a Hall of Fame type player. There's 8 or 9 more that I've voted for over the years. So I've tried not to vote for those steroid guys. Now, will I keep that pledge the rest of the time I vote? Well, I don't know, but that's my stance right now.
Kamish, question, though. You said you haven't voted for Jeff Bagwell?
I did vote for Jeff Bagwell because I didn't have as much information maybe on him, okay, or much suspicion as I had.
Why do you think people don't suspect Jeff Kent?
I've never heard anybody suspect Jeff Kent.
I mean,
don't know.
I've never really, like, Jeff Bagwell gets suspected, but Jeff Kent was like a short, stocky, power-hitting second baseman.
He was not short.
And he wasn't short. He wasn't stocky. And
he wasn't short or stocky.
He's more.
All right. Jeff Kent hit a lot of home runs and never got accused of doing steroids.
I think part of it was because he had positioned himself. He hit one off of Brad, and that's how we know. I mean, come on.
No, I covered Jeff.
Don't you think there are certain guys, though, that get attached for better or for worse, even if they have no... Uh-oh.
Or fine.
LaCroix
or fine.
Down.
Or We're fine.
I mean, like, Jeff Bagwell gets attached to steroids and certain other guys don't.
Yeah.
It's tough, isn't
but
it?
But I think part of it was because Jeff Kent had positioned himself as the anti-Bonds.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
Because he was the second baseman who hit 40 home runs?
No, and because in every way, he was the opposite side of the clubhouse. He was the opposite guy to talk to.
Hey, Drew.
Thanks, Drew.
Drew's showing off for his friends.
I'd vote for you for the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, I mean, he had positioned himself as the anti-Bonds. He was approachable. He was relatively approachable.
Yeah, Jeff Kent was a pretty—he was a pretty contrary guy, though. Basically.
No, yeah. But he was. I guess the opposite of Bonds. Yeah, yeah.
I guess my point was like a second baseman that hits that many home runs in that era. I would have assumed that people would have assumed steroids.
Well,
people assumed Bagwell was on steroids.
I assumed the '70s was on the greenies. I can't do anything about that. I mean, I can assume all I want.
And Kent was one of the first ball players who spoke up asking for testing for everybody. And I covered him for 2 years, and I had an interview with him in spring training where he like just laid out Bonds. And every other word was an F-bomb. And I'm thinking, and he's like, keep writing. Like, it's one of those where he just wants to go off. So I'm writing. And then I put expletive. Expletive. And the next morning, he's like, I'm never going to talk to you again. I'm like, what are you talking about? He goes, my wife just crushed me.
And you forget
that these very tough guys always have somebody back home who yells at them. Or like,
yeah, I guess I just wonder why, like, Bagwell and Biggio get accused of stuff and Jeff Kent doesn't. Anyway.
Let me tell you why Bagwell and Biggio. Because of Caminiti. Caminiti admitted to it. Biggio and Caminiti were very close. Caminiti's buried in Biggio's ranch. And Bagwell, they all ran together. So they all got... I understand that, but
there's a group of three friends and one of them cheats on their wife. That doesn't mean that all three of them cheat on their wife. Oh, yeah, they were all injecting each other in their asses. Jen, I want to ask you.
As the person that doesn't have a Hall of Fame vote.
But as you cover and watch the way that this has gone down over the last 10 to 15 years, what's your reaction and how do you think that the steroid era and what we know now influences what the future of the game and what the history of the game will be over the next 50 years?
Well, I think the history of the game is a big thing on this subject for me, because to me, Cooperstown and the Baseball Hall of Fame represents the history of this game. And part of the history of this game, whether we want to talk about it or not, is the steroid era. And I think, you know, my thinking on this subject has evolved in time, and as I think it has for a lot of baseball writers. If I were voting, I probably would include those guys on my ballot if they merited consideration, because that was an era of this game that I don't think we can ignore as a baseball historian. Now, maybe on their plaque, especially if we know that they were a steroid user, you identify that. But when people walk through those halls, they can see that this was part of the game. And generations from now, when they look back and they read about the history, this was a part of the game, maybe a dark period, but I don't think it can be ignored. So I do think that eventually we are going to see some of these guys start to get into the Hall of Fame, maybe not the baseball writers voting, maybe some of the veterans committees down the road. But I personally wouldn't have a problem seeing them represented in Cooperstown.
Or you could put a asterisk on Ty Cobb's plaque. This guy beat his wife. Derek, you fought for transparency. It was, honestly, I think one of the most incredible things that we've seen over the last few years, because if we know the way that people think, then we can talk about the process. Why was that important to you, and how do you think that will affect the way that writers vote, but also the way that we see the Hall moving forward?
The last two are ones that we've wrestled a lot with, and we don't really know the answers to that. You know, it doesn't mean that for the first time we'll have a 100% guy. Buster Olney and I have a bet. He thinks it'll be Mariano Rivera. I think it'll be Derek Jeter. And
really?
Yeah, if we have public ballots, does that push that even further along? Does that bring that about? Because you don't want to be one of the two, three voters
who didn't vote for Ken Griffey Jr. Why it was important is because we're writers. We're in the business of transparency. We're also in the business of putting our names on the stories that we write, and that is accountability. And I think that the Hall has given us a great responsibility, and the price of that responsibility, as I vaguely quote Spider-Man here, is accountability. You owe it to the fans to explain. This is my perspective, and other writers disagree, but you owe it to the fans to explain your thinking. I also think that the transparency or the light of day is a great disinfectant, and I don't just mean that for the voters. I mean that for the conversation. I have seen so many conspiracy theories bubble up about, you know, smoke-filled rooms and people holding grudges and things like that that just couldn't be further from the truth, that just don't influence ballot voting or how somebody handles their ballot, and yet it gains currency because we have secret ballots, because we have ballots held out. And I think to forward the conversation along, we need to have full disclosure as to what's happening. You know, and there's going to be pushback for it. And I've heard some really good arguments as to why it's a problem. We sat in the meeting where I proposed it, and there were some really compelling arguments made. And one of them is that, you know, you're going to invite some bullying on Twitter. Welcome to the world, man. I wake up to bullying on Twitter at times. That's just part of the job. And if you make a ballot that you can defend, then that is your shield. Know that if you can defend your vote, if you've thought through your vote, as the three people clearly already have, you know, presented up here, that they can defend their ballot, then that is the biggest shield of them all, and you have truth on your side.
You know, and that's what I've always appreciated. When you have cast your ballot, especially when you cast it for Yachty a couple of years ago,
yeah, the MVP.
You were there with a, I don't know how many words, 1,500-word piece about why you voted for Yachty or Belita. And it was not as the beat writer of the Cardinals. It was as a voter for the MVP. And I think people appreciate that. I think we get sucked into a vacuum of our own town and our own team so often. And when you can take yourself out of that and write about why you voted for someone and, you know, the reasons you voted for them, I mean, I, as a baseball fan, appreciated that.
Yeah. I mean, I took a grilling in Pittsburgh, as Jen would know. And
because McCutcheon was the trendy vote, and yeah, the Pirates overachieved that.
Rick also voted for Yachty, one overall. And, you know, we were raked over the coals. I reached out to every Pittsburgh radio station who had some fun at my expense or tried to have some goofy play on words with my name, which is kind of difficult. It's not hard. I mean, it's just not creative.
Shout out to Boy Wonder, by the way.
Yeah.
What's up, Ian?
He appeared in that, too. I went on MLB Network for Brian Kenny, and he made defend myself, and Ian decided to.
He just
to
yelled about how wins are meaningless.
Why are you shouting at me?
But use some hair gel, Brian.
But I approached the Pittsburgh radio station and said, yeah, look, man, you want to take this on, you can do it, you know, from your ivory tower over there. You can have me on, and I'll defend it. I'm good with that. And, you know, if Andrew McCutcheon had an issue with it, I've only ever had one player have an issue with a vote that I made.
Tony Cruz.
Yeah, Tony Cruz.
Hang on, before we talk about anything else.
That was Gio Gonzalez.
Oh,
yeah.
of the Nationals.
Yeah.
Wait, what vote?
I didn't vote for him for the Cy Young.
What vote concerned Gio?
I didn't vote for him for the Cy Young.
Well, neither would I have.
Well, he led the league in wins.
Neither would I have.
Well, he was a finalist for the award. I didn't have him on the ballot.
Oh, the old Rick Porcello.
And that's the thing about the BBWA. We catch a lot of flack, but our voters are more like Derek.
Yes.
We always
they're all like that.
That's what I'm saying. There's rare exceptions, but, you know, I had to defend. I wore it in 2014 because of the Dan Le Batard, and that was the year I was the vice president. And I've always thought that I've learned from the fans, and I respect. It's my vote, but I know there are many fans, many bloggers that know baseball way more than I do. So I would do, since my first vote in 2007, I would do a dinner in which I'd invite fans and we'd discuss the ballot and have dinner. You know, 1 year, you know, I had a Texas Supreme Court judge. And when Levitard sold his vote to Deadspin, I wore it because some people wanted to take shots at the BBWA, at the Houston Chronicle, at me. And there's nothing quite like having Keith Olbermann do a whole segment in which he's reading your blog from 10 years ago or 8 years ago and, you know, making you out to be some drunk drinking tequila. And because we were at a Mexican restaurant, you know, and but I always defended my ballot, and I still do, and most of us do. But, you know, some people have agendas against the voters, and we wear it.
Well, I've got no agenda against any of you guys.
I don't vote for the, by the way, I haven't voted for Bonds. And yeah, I haven't voted for him.
Although, Clemens, did you see the YouTube video of him in camp with the Giants this year? Just crushing dingers.
Well, he would do it. He would do the shows. Do you remember the shows in Miami when he was the
He was just crushing dingers.
Did you go over there and see that, Jen? He was the disinterested hitting coach of the Miami Marlins for a few months. And he thought hitting coach was go hit. And he would go on.
I don't think he didn't do much preparation.
No, he just would go and rake and go do that.
It was amazing. He looked better than anyone on that team.
D. Gordon would go, can't do that.
Oh, what one of these things is just like the other. Steroids. I mean, what? D. Gordon took steroids. Yeah. I will leave you guys with this, and then we'll wrap up.
We have time for more questions.
Do we have? Oh, okay. Let's take more questions. All right. I'm looking at the stage clock here. Gould, but
I know, but you're missing the hands.
I know, but if Ian is okay to stay up. Uh-oh. All right. You, sir, right here in the blue shirt.
We've talked a lot about baseball and the players and how it's changed.
Uh-oh, here we go. So let's talk music.
Right. Well, specific to your industry, I would make an argument that maybe as writers, your guys' industry is changing more than baseball has, especially for the last 10 to 15 years. The internet and social media, how have you guys adapted, and what do you see as the next 15 to 20 years of being baseball writers and the PWWA, whatever, you know, letter that is?
Good question, Derek.
Me? Okay. Oh, well, then we'll get Kamish. I mean, because he's been around for many more decades than the rest of us. To see
whoa,
it evolve.
Easy.
No.
Whoa.
You know I love you, Rick. But just, I've covered baseball now for 11 years, and I came in straight to MLB.com, which was in its infancy still, kind of in 2007 when I arrived. But, you know, that's where we're seeing so much coverage now is it's all trending online, and we at MLB.com have found a way to monetize content. I think that's one of the things you're going to see coverage journalism go to. They've got to find a way to put a dollar value to what we do. But just in kind of the way that I do my job, when I started in 2007, I didn't tweet, I didn't post on Facebook, I didn't go on the radio, I didn't do live hits from the ballpark, I didn't do podcasts. And all those things are now daily operations for in what we do. I mean, it is literally a 24/7 job. I mean, you are always on call. You are always connected. We are very much connected with you guys in a way that we weren't. If you wanted to reach me in 2007, you either wrote a letter or you penned an email. Now you can scream at me in 140 characters, and you can do it all day. So a lot has changed in that regard, and it's, you know, funny to listen to Kamish talk about, you know, being an afternoon paper where you had all these hours to get your story done and really craft it. We're in the business of immediacy right now, and I think one of the perils there is that we've sacrificed accuracy. Some in our industry have sacrificed accuracy for immediacy, and I don't think that's a good trend, and I mean, we think we kind of need to get away from that. But everything is in real time in a way that it wasn't even just 11 years ago when I started.
The future, by the way, we're just going to do the chat by Bluetooth. I'm going to plug in Matrix style, right? And that's how we'll do it. I'll sleep through the whole thing. It's going to be fantastic.
You can't sit on scoops now. I mean, I remember just 2005, the Carlos Beltran negotiation with the Mets, Yankees. I was sitting on information, and then you'd wait till the latest moment so your competition wouldn't be able to catch up, and then you would enjoy reading the next day, like, who quoted, you know, the Houston Chronicle back then. And now, like, as soon as you get it, you better put it up because it's you don't get the credit for the breaking story if you wait. And that's been the biggest deal now with Twitter. You're always trying to put stuff up. You're doing video. I remember the Blues when they fired Ken Hitchcock. I get a text message from my boss saying, hey, we'd like some video. So I'm sitting in the middle of the press, you know, with taking
yep,
video.
Yep, you're on the ground. Yep. Yeah,
taking video. And people are looking at me like, what the heck are you doing? I'm doing my job, which wasn't my job. And people are like, that's our job now.
Kamish, what? I heard you say that when you started, your mother was typing your stories for you. You were dictating stories to her?
Well, I wrote them out longhand. Now,
But how much... Tell us about that, and then, in all seriousness, it's changed. It's all changed.
Well, I wanted
dictating
to
his mom. I mean, that's incredible.
Wrote him out longhand.
I wanted to be a broadcaster.
Gave them to his mother longhand.
I wanted to be a broadcaster when I was a kid in high school, and my driver's training instructor was also a broadcaster for one of the radio stations in Quincy, Illinois, where I grew up, and he'd been a player. As was his brother, his twin brother was a player, and actually was managing the Cubs at that time, Alvin Tappy. This was Melvin Tappy, his brother. And he said, you know, this is 1962, he told me this. He says, these broadcasting jobs are going to go to all the ex-players. And what you really ought to do is be a sports writer if you wanted to stay in the business, because I already could tell I wasn't going to be a good enough player to be anything in baseball or anything, any sport. So a couple years later, I went to college, Quincy College, and I worked on the radio station a little bit, and I also was going to cover some stuff for the weekly newspaper, basketball, football. They had good soccer up there then, and I would write these stories. I didn't know how to type yet, though. See, so my mother did some professional typing on the side, so I'd write these things down for her. She'd type them up. I'd walk them back over to the newspaper office, and that worked fine for the first year. The second year I was there, I thought, you know, I'm going to be going to a lot of games here. I'm not sure Mom can make all these games. I better learn how to type. So I did. And so now I think back to the days when I started. It was Underwood Olivetti typewriter. And then now we're into the everything else and online and so forth. And I'm lucky. I'm very lucky that Derek works for the Post-Dispatch, because I don't get involved in much of the tweeting or Facebook or anything like that, and Derek is a monster on that stuff. He covers me in more ways than I could possibly describe. So, I have some familiarity with online work. I can do blogs. I can do some things, but not nearly as many as he, and not nearly as many as my bosses want. But they don't care anymore now about me being able to do that. And 20 years from now, I will not be covering the Cardinals.
Well, we're glad to have you,
Kamish.
Well,
don't say that.
We are glad
Somebody
to have you.
Has to.
We had a couple questions. Yes, sir, right there in the red sweater vest.
First of all, as someone who takes his sports very seriously, as I imagine most of us do here, it's a treat to be with you guys in panel number one, too.
You're welcome.
The question I have is, so let's say you've got somebody in a journalism school and not necessarily being a sports writer, what advice going from Jesus, and sweeping the panel, what advice would you have for a young journalism student?
Read as much as possible, write as much as possible, and if you want to cover baseball, and you can, try to learn Spanish. Try to be bilingual. 30% of the ball players speak Spanish. It's what got me my start at a very young age in New York. That's what got me to New York. That and David Cohn's Perfect Game, and it's a different skill set that a lot of people can benefit from.
Well, I took French and Latin when I was growing up, and not many ballplayers speak French, and darn few speak Latin.
A couple of thriving languages.
Now, I would say, even though I don't do it, the best advice I would have would be to know as much about the online industry as possible, because that's where it's going to be. Newspapers will be publishing only on Sundays many years from now. Maybe, I don't know how many years from now, but they'll be publishing that day and maybe a few others, not 7 days a week. But online will be every minute, every day.
I can top you, Kamish. I majored in French So, no, but still waiting to know, but still waiting to use it. I wish I had taken Spanish. If only I had the foresight. I would say to journalism students a couple things. Number one, diversify your skills. You know, everything that we do is now multimedia. So again, I got into this business to be a writer, but I don't just write anymore. I write, I have to be comfortable on camera. I do radio. I have to take video. I have to take photos. So, you know, be comfortable and get experience in all those areas. It's going to make you more marketable when you go out to look for a job. And then just, you know, if it's for students on campus too, take advantage of every opportunity you can on campus to get job experience. You won't believe how many students kind of get to their senior year and, hey, this is what I want to do. Now what do I do? And, well, you missed all those opportunities to work for the athletic department or the local newspaper. Just write, report, whatever it is that you want to do, get that experience early, and it's invaluable moving forward.
I took 4 years of Russian.
It's a bit of a hot topic these days.
I was way ahead of the game.
Do you think?
Because can I 10 years you? From now, totally got baseball covered.
I'm going to need to get you in front of a grand jury.
I would echo what was said here. You know, I usually tell folks that, you know, you have to write a lot, get a lot of practice, and as much as you write, read 10 times as much. Now when I talk to students, I change it just a little bit, and I think every time somebody tells you, well, write around it or write your way through it, that you should replace the verb with report, because there are a lot of writers out there. There's a lot of people who fancy themselves writers. There are a lot of people who are excellent writers out there. What this business needs more of is the people who report to become great writers, because the bedrock of any great story that you read, whether it's one written by Rick or whether it's written by somebody else at Sports Illustrated or whether it's a blog that you really like going to, like Fangraphs, the bedrock of it is the reporting and the research. It's not the writing. A lot of people can link verbs and put together metaphors and come up with a cute simile or, you know, dance across a keyboard, but the substance is the reporting, and I would really stress that to students. Every time somebody gives you advice about writing your way out of it, replace the verb. It's report.
It's great advice.
Bring it. Bring it on. Oh, absolutely. Oh, don't get me started. Okay. All right. All right. Here we go.
Wow.
Now we're going.
Hang on.
Okay.
You're ready to, like, get out there and fight someone.
Because I thought he was going to go the other way, but you're exactly right. Yeah, Hockman's braced. Hockman just put on a seatbelt. Okay.
Stop talking about similes. Shots fired at Hockman.
No. Because he's heard it. Because he's heard it all. But you're so right. And here's where this is going. All right. There. Jen moved away. This is the concern. All right. Is that you're right. What ESPN did, Mark Saxon, who's a good friend of ours, Mark Saxon, who brought a really wonderful voice.
Fucking sucked so bad. I'm sorry. That
sucks. I mean, he brought a great voice and a great sense.
That sucked so bad.
He brought a lot to the beat, and so did a lot of the other people who lost their position. What we see, however, is we see that there's an emphasis on who shouts. There's an emphasis on who picks a topic and runs with the hot take and makes it into a volcanic inferno of supposition and screaming. And there is no framework to hang that on, because beat writers provide that framework. You know, it's the reporters and the journalists, and now we have beat columnists and stuff like that. That's who creates the framework for the opinions to hang, for the anchors to describe. And by laying off the people who provide that information, now there's nothing to hang it on. You know, that fancy, frilly shirt that you gave a three-year contract to because they look good on TV and they can link sentences together, if it doesn't have the hanger of fact that a beat writer provides to hang, it's just going to lie there rumpled on the floor. And more we're seeing hangers laid off.
Round of applause for that.
And yeah, thanks.
Ian, I'm sorry for that.
Hears it every day.
I mean, it's like Mark, I think we'd all say, is one of the best guys and one of the best. And he's like an old school reporter. He's the guy that got Dexter Fowler talking about the immigration ban. Like, He's one of the best dudes that we know, and ESPN got him to relocate his family from Los Angeles to St. Louis, and I don't care if he's being paid for the rest of his contract. He got fired. He's done, and it sucks. So anyway, pour some out for Mark Saxon. I'm sorry. Don't even get me started on this because it fires me up. Anybody else have a question? Yes, sir, right over there. And we'll get to you and we'll get to everybody. As long as Kevin Kennedy is cool with us taking all the rest of the questions. Yes, sir. Saturdays are for the boys, eh, Kamish?
Well, I think in general players had
nobody
more fun.
Nobody gets that reference?
Players had more fun playing.
See,
in 67,
Kamish,
82,
85. McCarver made a comment yesterday. He said, we had fun before we won. And he said in baseball, it's not something that happened. He said, we had fun before we won.
Well, there weren't a lot of distractions as there are now. Everybody made the same money, pretty much. You didn't have guys making $10 million and other guys making $500,000. You had guys who had maybe played with each other for several years before the championship. It wasn't like they had a whole new team coming in every year because you had no free agency then. You'd have 10 or 15 guys go out together after a game rather than maybe 12 blocks of two or three guys going out after a game. Not that that's bad now. They didn't have agents telling them what to do. They didn't have disabled lists that they had to, you know, go on just because they had something a little bit wrong with them. Everything was different, and they didn't have a swarm of media around them. They knew every reporter that was around them after the game. Now you have bloggers and radio people and stuff, and some guys don't want to talk now because they don't know exactly to whom they are speaking. If they knew the four of us and the folks over here and a few others, they'd be fine with that. But there's 20 people show up there and they go, oh, hold on, I'm going to go back in the lunchroom or the training room or the video room or the weight room. We could go anywhere we wanted to in the 80s and 70s. You just walk into the training room and say, how you doing, you know? Try to get in there now.
I think that 06 team was a lot of fun to be around because they didn't know what they were pulling off. They were having a great time. Plus, you had some personalities that, to be frank, meshed really well, and other ones that did not mesh at all. Roland and Supon there in the clubhouse after the Game 7 victory at Shea Stadium, the two of them and the moment that they shared is that's friendship and bailing people out at the highest level. And then the moments that Roland and Tony shared were the opposite of that. And there was a fracture of trust on both sides, and I think that team was a lot of fun, mainly because they were 83 wins and they had nothing to lose, and they knew they were talented and wanted to show the world how talented they were, and played like it.
It for me, the 2004 and 2005 Astros, because it's a football town, football state, and they captured everybody's attention. And they all got along. Jeff Bagwell, to this day, is the person I've covered who I respect the most because he unified that clubhouse. There weren't cliques. Everybody just followed Bagwell. After the game, before the game, the Christian Coalition, the Hispanic, everybody, like Berkman and Bagwell, are really tight. And they are the most different people you've ever seen. But they were united. And then, you know, in New York, that 2000 Mets team was crazy because you had the manager who didn't like half his players and half his players hated him, but they kept winning.
I don't think I covered any fun teams in Pittsburgh. they were losing on average 100 games a year during my tenure there. I think Rafael Furcal and Lance Berkman made every team fun. So that 2012 team, which was my first year here, that was a lot of fun.
Hey, and everybody says Berkman. Why was Berkman such a fun? You just said the word fun. Why was he just a fun guy?
He was
guy
friends with everybody, and he was outspoken, and he was honest, and he was genuine and authentic. And I think in this business now, where players are always on edge and they don't know who's watching or who might be, you know, writing out what they say, we don't necessarily see players for who they are anymore because they feel like they have to be composed and scripted, and Berkman was anything but that.
So is he the guy that every game, pregame, if he needed to, like, because I
feel
bad.
He was a go-to quote. Yeah.
Well, I feel bad because, like, Piscotty's that guy, and it's like, God, everyone's knows that he's going to be there pregame, so they're around his locker pregame waiting for him to just talk. And now I feel like he's giving the same quotes. But was Berkman that guy pregame? He'd be sitting there, but he'd give you something?
Yeah, and I think it was good to have a veteran voice as that. You know, when things were going not well, he would be there and be accountable and kind of speak for the team. And
Carlos Beltran, I feel like, was
Carlos
that guy
was
for
the
a
same
couple
way.
Years. Yeah.
It was the same way. And then probably, and this isn't going to sit well in this audience, but I did help out with coverage of the postseason last year, and that Cubs team had a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were throwing, like, raves in the clubhouse after they would win, and you could tell that it was just a special group of players that loved being around each other and were on a very special mission, and that might have been the funnest kind of group that I had ever been around.
Try not to suck. All right, I'm told.
No Ross.
He was at Busch Stadium yesterday.
He was.
All right.
And he was posing for photos with his former teammates.
We've got to wrap up. I'm told that we've got to wrap this up. However, we will be in the back if y'all want to have a drink at the bar. I'm going to leave this, our final question, one word answer. Where will the Cardinals finish in the Central this year? One word answer, and then we'll all go hang out in the back bar and have a cocktail. So one word answer, Derek Gould, where will the Cardinals finish this year in the National League Central?
Second.
Jen Langosh?
Second.
Second.
You can ask us in the back. Thank you guys so much. Thank you to Del Mar Hall. Thank you to Kevin. Thank you to Pitch Talks.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you so much for coming out. We appreciate it. What a blast it was.